I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I'm very pleased to be joined now by Graham Kerr, internationally known for his legendary television program, The Galloping Gourmet. Mr. Kerr has been on television since 1960 in the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, here in Canada, and around the world. He is a best-selling author and an award-winning culinary personality. Next month, here in Vancouver, Mr. Kerr will be one of the personalities headlining the Eat Vancouver Food and Cooking Festival, June 10th, 11th, and 12th. Check out their website at eat-vancouver.com for more information. The Galloping Gourmet program was known for its humor and generous use of butter, cream, fat, and alcohol. Now Mr. Kerr and his wife Trina, who produce the television programs, are promoting less hedonistic values. I'll ask him about his goals to increase vegetable and fruit consumption and reduce portion sizes. His website is at grahamkerr.com. His latest book is called Growing at the Speed of Life, A Year in the Life of My First Kitchen Garden from Mount Vernon, Washington. Please welcome to the Planta Online program Graham Kerr. Good morning, Mr. Kerr.
Hello, Joseph. Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. Now, how long have you lived in Mount Vernon?
We've lived in the Northwest altogether now since 1980 and sort of have risen to the surface. We're gradually encroaching on Vancouver, B.C. We started down in Salem, Oregon, then went up to Tacoma, then Copeland and Kamano Island, and now here.
How far is Mount Vernon from Vancouver? It's less than an hour, right?
Yes, it's about an hour, and depending on the sort of the backup of the enthusiasts getting into Canada, it's a lovely run, and it's always great fun to be in Vancouver, BC.
Now, you'd traveled around the world. Why did you settle in this part of the world?
I think if you take the microclimate, a growing kind of microclimate from Vancouver, BC, down to Portland, shall we say. And it does get a few degrees warmer, but basically it's Cascadia. It's this side of the mountains. And because of which we get that Pacific moist air that comes in and equitable climate, lovely people who don't seem to be parading themselves from any particular place. So that's what we wanted. We just wanted a place where we could hang out with the locals and be who we are.
Yeah. Growing up, you grew up in England. Did you always cook?
It seems so. My dad forbade me to talk to the customers in the bar when I was 10. I grew up in the hotel business, and
right.
It was obviously illegal and boring. And so I was given, I'm an only child, and the hotel that my father ran at that time was right in the middle of the country in Sussex in England. And so there were no kids around for me to play with, so a guy has to hang out somewhere. So I was taken to the kitchen, and the chef built a little orange box thing, which was made in wood in those days, for me, and stood me on it and gave me a small knife and taught me how not to cut my fingers off, and so I actually played in the kitchen until I was 16, and during that time and graduated to the dining room, where I was a chef d'orange, it's a cooking table side, I guess that's where I learned something of the patter at the same time as cooking. So now, yes, it seems like forever.
Yeah. Now, do you cook every day?
Yes, I do. I don't want to run the risk of sounding as if I'm obsessive compulsive, but my wife Trina says that I'm certainly borderline. I think I've done about 41,000 meals.
Really?
Mostly all for Trina and my family and my mum when she was alive. So I'm very much orientated towards being a family cook rather than a professional one, if you like.
Yeah. Now, there's a bit of interference on the line. Do you hear that?
Yes, just a bit.
Or is it just
probably
at
my ear? Yeah. I'll try and stop it.
Now, you were one of the first cooking personalities on television. Is that correct?
Yes, I think it would be. Of course, James Beard started very early. He started early in the United States, about the same time that I started early in New Zealand. I began in New Zealand within 3 months of the very first signal being sent out. In fact, it was only 50 television sets in the whole country when I began there. So, and he started in about that sort of time frame in the United States. But Julia Child was well known starting in about 63. I joined in the United States. I started in New Zealand 60 and then got to the United States by 67, 68.
Now, when you look at television today and you just see the glut of shows that are on with regards to cooking and we have networks now, did you foresee that happening at the time you started?
No, I don't think anybody did. First start, chefs were very busy being chefs and didn't appear to... there was no such thing as a celebrity chef. We were writers and speakers about food, and the word gourmet was you know, perfectly apt. The word chef was not. And so nowadays, it seems it's an extended public relations idea. The chefs are very brilliant and very talented, and many times great communicators. And I suspect the only difference would be that in the older days we spent more time, maybe we had some budget that could be useful. It seems today that it's more of a production line than a production. So that in the old days you may get a wonderful Duesenberg car, which would be handmade. Now you get a beautiful, magnificent motor car that is made on a production line. And, you know, the end product, I suspect, is probably more seamless and very professional, whereas the old one was a little clunky and got around. But it was, but it was handmade, and I think when a thing is taken time over, it develops a certain pattern and pleasure to it, which I think the production line has a tendency to lose.
Now, your wife Trina, she was instrumental in the television program, The Galloping Gourmet. Well, what impact did she have on, say, how the show, sort of the things that we remember about the show, the jumping off the chair, the humor?
Oh, everything, everything. I was so concerned at 26 years of age, which I was when I had a national television show between Peyton Place and the Avengers at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night. You know, that's where I was in New Zealand. And I was so concerned at 26 that I really didn't know enough about food to be able to stand there on television and occupy a primetime space like that. So I put in a great deal of effort and always have in what it was that I do. She, on the other hand, saw this as boring, and she said, you know, you really are the most unutterably boring man. And I said, well, I've got to do this right. She said, I understand. You do it right, but at least give me the opportunity. And I said, if you're so clever, why don't you produce the show? And she said, okay, I will, and give me the opportunity of fashioning at least the first 6 minutes of the show. You turn that over to me, then you do whatever you do afterwards. But I want that first 6 minutes. And it was that first 6 minutes which completely turned the whole food world upside down, because nobody had ever done a thing like that before.
And so the show ran for how long? About 3-4 years, right?
Yes, it did, as its first runs. And then sporadically, it just keeps on coming back to life. I mean, we jokingly say that if you watch it carefully, you see Lassie barking its way through the back of the tape. It's been worn so thin by now. You know, it played for over 20 years in Japan and places like this. It's one of those things that is relatively timeless.
And so you had the show ended because you had had an accident, right? And you were paralyzed for a bit?
Run into by a vegetable truck,
and
partially paralyzed on one side. I really couldn't stand up for more than about 20 minutes at a time. And we had a wonderful doctor who suggested that we would take get a boat and sail around the world, or at least go sailing and catch your balance and pull some lines. And so we did just that. We actually took off in a boat and did do 24,000 miles, pretty well nonstop, and just lived aboard as a family, which was a wonderful time and a great firebreak experience between, you know, the high celebrity, high speed life and trying to catch your balance and be a human being.
And when was it when your wife had the stroke and the heart attack?
That was in 87, now I suppose it's about 26 years away now. And this was a real wake-up call for both of us. I'd already made decisions with regard to the style of eating and to eat cleaner, if you will. And she, on the other hand, hadn't quite reached that, and we had a kind of legalism battle between us, and which she won and I compromised. And it was 8 years later that she had the stroke and the heart attack. And I strongly believe that if you make rules about food, then you get rebellion. And if you get a rebellion, then you make a compromise just to be able to keep the peace. And if you compromise, you're compromising your future health. And if you've got a genetic problem like Trina has, with both her parents who died young from heart disease, then the chances, if you're going to make compromises, of a future disease coming to roost are very, very strong. And so we learned that. And fortunately, we both agreed that we were going to make some changes and we would do it more creatively and less legalistically. And that's been the whole public career that I've had. What we've done in private, we've also spilled out in public.
So now you promote healthy eating. You eschew cream, fat, and butter. What's the diet now?
I hate to call it a diet. I would much prefer it, a list of personal preferences.
Right.
I've got a website where I have a food preference sheet and a favorite food list on the website, and it's perfectly free, and there's no advertising there either, so I have no reason other than if your listeners should want to look at this, it's simply grahamcare.com, and it's called the food preference sheet. And what you do is you just simply go down with members of your family and tick off the foods that you like. Then you look at the list of 36 foods that probably don't like you. And by the way, there are only about 36 that we eat traditionally rather large portions of. And when we exceed the reasonable portion size, then we are placing ourselves at risk and our family. And we call that the threat syndrome. But if you take the word threat and lift the letter H out of that word, it becomes the word treat. And I see no reason why food should not be a treat. So all we did was we took the threat out, the H factor, out of our food, and analyzed that, and simply filled in that space with the foods that we did like that were non-threatening, and which are largely plant foods. And that's the method.
And so there's nothing really that you cut out, right?
No, I don't think you should say that you cut things out. I think you should say perhaps that you reduce the portion size, and then find the things that you really do like, which are going to be beneficial to you. And it becomes a list of your preferences. You just simply cook with the foods you enjoy. And that has a way of automatically improving the quality of the food that you eat.
Now, the habits of Americans, and I'd say they'd be the same in Canada, are that we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. You're big in changing that. What's the easiest way that we can incorporate more fruits and vegetables in our diets?
Well, first of all, I think, Joe, that the most important thing is the speed at which we get it. And therefore, that the farmers' markets of today, they're well worth finding out where they are and go pay them a visit. See what looks as fresh. It's usually been dug up the night before or even that morning and brought to the market. Now, this is the very freshest food that there is that you can buy. Probably the I'm hunting for the it's the Community Sustainable Agriculture, CSA.
Yeah.
That's another way of getting very fresh food in your home. But I suppose the freshest way of all is simply to grow it yourself. And that's why in this recent book, and the one that I will have at EAT to sign, is called Growing at the Speed of Life. And I just simply dug up my backyard and planted stuff. And I did it in three different ways. I got a little greenhouse so that I could try and do it all year round, which is not that easy, I found out. Second one is container, a thing called an earth box, which is quite a large container which sort of self-waters, and that's very useful, and could be on a patio, any place that you've got space for. And then I dug up about one-tenth of an acre and planted eventually grow boxes and highly intensive agricultural system, and I've really enjoyed that one, and it's been tremendously productive. So my theory is this: if you just simply try and do one single plant, and let's call it a tomato, let's do a tomato like Sun Gold, which is an extremely sweet little tomato, and it grows, and you succeed, and you crop these out, you take them off the vine and take them into the kitchen and eat those, they are so good, so comparatively excellent, that you get the idea that maybe this business that people talk about, eat up your fruit and vegetables, this may be actually a delicious idea. And it's been my experience that when you grow the thing yourself, it is so extraordinary, the added interest you have in preparing that food properly. You've taken it everywhere from seed, you've nurtured it, you've fertilized it, you've made sure the weeds didn't take over, and got it just at the right moment, and oh my goodness, the quality of that is so excellent. So that's my theory, and also, if I may add, the people who eat the most vegetables live the longest and live with less disease than other people. I mean, this is statistically absolutely true. The oldest living people on earth at the moment are Seventh-day Adventists who are classically almost completely vegetarian. And they're living in California. There's 187,000 of them, and they live about 9 years longer as men and 6 years longer than women than the average people in North America, including California.
Yeah. Mm. Do you find that you're able to grow everything you need?
No, absolutely
no.
No. No, I mean, I'm only in my third year, but I'm really trying. I grow more than I need of certain crops, and then share those with food bank and with neighbors, and that's a great joy. But there are things that I just, potatoes would be a waste of space. They're so low cost, there's no point to it. And I happen to, the Skagit Valley is a great potato area, and we have wonderful potatoes. So I don't do that sort of thing. I don't grow corn. I'm growing things where I'm increasingly interested in heirloom seeds that develop the very best quality of taste, consistent with its ability to be able to be grown in this microclimate. So, and I have several years to go for gardening, and I intend to be really quite expert about what grows best in our area from Vancouver, BC to Portland.
Now, when you look back at your career in television and you look back at sort of the life that you had, the sort of jet-set life, the hedonism, do you regret that? I mean, your life has changed a great deal.
I've always tried to do what, well, I'm not sure whether I tried, or perhaps it's just my nature, to do the best I can at whatever I'm doing, and to put all my enthusiasm into doing that. I suppose if you start out cooking a crepe Suzette in your father's hotel in England, in Sussex, and you're chatting up the couple who are, you're making the crepe Suzette for, and you're telling them this marvelous story about how it started, was folding the little crepe in the orange and lemon and grand marnier and kirsch and then pushing it out onto the plate, and there you are, madam, there you are. It's that kind of personal enthusiasm and connection to what one is doing. So do I regret it? No, not a bit. Of course, if I look back now and say, was that dangerous? Yes, if you make a habit out of eating that sort of food often, certainly. I really, really, really want to say to people today, I tried to delight, and now I try to delight and do less harm. That's the difference.
Now, you'll be at Eat Vancouver next month. You'll be signing the book. Will you be cooking as well?
Yes. Yeah, I thought I would like to sort of suggest, since it's now been 50 years between when I published the first book, I'm going to bring that up with me as a first book. And in that first book, I have an omelette. And the omelette is a very classic French omelette, and it's just dripping with saturated fat.
Right.
And it's really delicious, no doubt. And I have reinvented the omelette, if you will, completely, so that I want to present a really, really different omelette, one which has very much less risk attached to it, but which in its presentation and design is completely different from any other omelette you've ever seen. And I will cook the two, bring somebody out of the audience, put the both of them in front of that person and say, now go on and taste. Did I delight? Yes, I hope. Did I delight and do less harm? Well, let's see. And so I really want to submit that to whoever it is who comes out. And that person will not be predetermined.
Right.
That will be a last-minute choice that I will make by just looking into the crowd and jumping at that one person. I've always done that. I've always wanted there to be a completely unset-up person who would taste what it is that I cook.
Graham, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and we'll see you at Eat Vancouver next month.
Thank you very much. I look forward to that. Bless you.
Graham Kerr will be headlining the Eat Vancouver Festival here June 10th, 11th, and 12th. That'll be at the Convention Center. Visit eat-vancouver.com for more information and grahamkerr.com for more. Graham Kerr on the line from Mount Vernon, Washington in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.